Srimad Bhagavatam 11, Canto, Chapter 18, Description of Varnashrama Dharma, Text 40 and 41. Translation. One who has not controlled the six forms of illusion, lust, anger, greed, excitement, false pride, and intoxication, whose intelligence, the leader of the senses, is extremely attached to material things, who is bereft of knowledge and detachment, who adopts the sannyas order of life to make a living, who denies the worshipable demigods, his own self and the supreme lord within himself, thus ruining all religious principles, and who is still infected by material contamination, is deviated and lost both in this life and the next. Purport. Lord Krishna here condemns bogus personalities who adopt the sannyas order of life for sense gratification while still maintaining all the symptoms of gross illusion. A false show of sannyas is never accepted by intelligent followers of Vedic principles. So-called sannyasis who ruin all Vedic religious principles sometimes become famous among foolish persons, but they are simply cheating themselves and their followers. These charlatan sannyasis are never actually engaged in the loving devotional service of Lord Krishna. Om Agyana Chimarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militan Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasavi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The way the material world works is that there'll always be something genuine and there'll always be something that is false. That is the nature of material existence. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Gabhuta Saga Lokesmin Daiva Asraevacha. The two categories of conditioned souls have been there since time immemorial. The asuras, those who think, just do as you feel, find happiness in your own way. And those who are pious, the suras, who understand that human life is meant for regulation and discipline. Just as the sixth canto of Bhagavatam says, bulls, they have a yoke, the ring in the nose, the yoke, and they go where their driver wants them to go. Similarly, all human beings are under the control of Dharma. That's what it means to be pious. There'll always be these two classes, Krishna explains. Those who are convinced, just do as you feel, find happiness in your own way, it's all right. And those who look to find universal standards. And indeed, they worship the source of those universal standards. And such pious people understand that they cannot manufacture the principles of Dharma. Because Krishna, in his expansion as Paramatma, the super soul in everyone's heart, because he's omnipresent, he is entitled to decide what is Dharma. And how can we be so presumptuous to think, based on our tiny presence in a body, our tiny presence is such that we don't even know what the self is, yet we are going to decide what is Dharma. And what is that decision based on? Our conception of Dharma? Simply how this body and mind feel, and how other bodies and minds around me feel. That is Dharma. If it increases the bank account, and if it increases the samsparshaja bhoga, the enjoyment through the skin sensation, if those two things are in order, that's Dharma. Humility means to accept our tiny constitutional nature. We are not able to manufacture Dharma. And humility means to accept Krishna's supreme situation, because just by his super soul expansion, he's in everyone's heart. Krishna is able to establish Dharma. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur said, as you often heard, that there are two social classes in this world. Those who are cheating and those who are being cheated. So at some point in your life, you occupy one of these two classes. Sometimes you do simultaneously. You're cheating someone while someone's cheating you. That is the nature of material existence. Of course, people tend to think of cheating in terms of finances. Actually, cheating means to treat someone as if they're the body. That is cheating. You're cheating that person out of their spiritual advancement, and you're cheating yourself out of your spiritual advancement. So what does the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam say? Dharma projita kaita votra. Srimad Bhagavatam, right in the very beginning, kicks out all kinds of cheating. Kaitava dharma, as you've undoubtedly studied in Bhakti Shastri class. Kaitava dharma, cheating dharma, means so-called dharma, so-called religion, performed based on bhava identification, based on desiring things for the false self. The real self is the eternal servant of Krishna. So any so-called dharma that does not focus upon directly or indirectly your eternal constitutional position, that's cheating. So dharma projita kaitavocha. Bhagavatam sweeps all forms of kaitava dharmas, cheating religion, out the door, like you take a broom and just flick the dust out the door. Paramonamatsaranam satam. Bhagavatam is meant for those who are pure in heart. Now you may say, well, what's that got to do with us then? How can we say that we are pure in heart? But simply by trying, simply by sincerely embracing the process of sadhana bhakti, because we are followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we can enter into the mystery of Srimad Bhagavatam. This section of 11th Canto is describing Varnashram Dharma. The essence of Varnashram Dharma is you can't just do whatever you feel. And contemporary society finds this thought to be horrible. What do you mean you can't just do what you feel? You know yourself. You know your body. In fact, often people are advised by New Age therapists, if you want to know what's right or wrong, just consult your body. If your body gives a good feeling, then the action is right. If the body gives a bad feeling, then the action is wrong. Just consult your body. This is human advancement in the age of Kali. To realize that there is a higher standard for judging our life, for measuring our life, a higher standard than just how we feel at the moment, this is very difficult for people to accept today. Generation after generation is being raised in this manner. Parents know nothing better to tell their children than just follow your dream. Follow your own kind of happiness. We'll support whatever you do. That's the greatest knowledge that parents can give. They can't. They think there's nothing beyond such knowledge. How is it that people can understand in such a degraded period of human history? How is it that they can understand that there are guidelines, there are standards, There are rings that go in the nose of the bull and the cows. How are they supposed to understand that? It seems impossible. And that was the feeling Srila Prabhupada had when he first approached the North American continent. How will these people ever understand? But, he said, Krishna, you are the supreme mystic. By your mystic potency, you've put them into Maya. Therefore, you can also bring them out of Maya. Similarly, we should think, how will I ever be Krishna conscious? We take stock of our body and mind, we become horrified. Oh, so much trash is there, or residue is there. How will I ever be properly Krishna conscious? But that same Krishna who allowed us to go into Maya also will, when we convince him, he'll escort us out of Maya. You see, the Bhagavatam explains that actually Krishna, in one sense, does not create the material world. We create the material world by our wanting to live a life separate from Krishna. And Krishna just facilitates our misuse of independence. So in that sense, Krishna does not create the material world. He personally does not do it. But because we're like rebellious children, we're just pushing on the parent. I want this, I want this, I want this. Have you ever done that? What was it for? Toys. You saw it on what, television? Well, your friends had them. You went and saw in the shop. And you just made a whole campaign. You know, like politicians, they make campaigns. You don't know that yet. So you made a whole presentation. I must have, I want. So, do your parents, do they give in? Do they surrender? Sometimes. So Krishna has given in to our desires to enjoy separate from him. And he's facilitated that illegal desire. Regretfully, reluctantly. So in that sense, Krishna does not create the material world. And he, because he's own Purnam, perfect and complete, he fills the material world with unlimited opportunities for you to exit material existence. But we're so foolish because we're blinded by the six forms of illusion we read about here. Lust, anger, greed, excitement, false pride, and intoxication. We don't see the exit way. Like when there's a big fire in a public building, like a movie theater or something, and the air is full of smoke, and then the lights have gone out, and people may not be able to see the exit ways out of the public building. And so they just trample each other in madness. So this is what we're doing in our material existence. There's ample exits, but we don't see. Just like in this room. There's this door, and then there's another door. By the law, by the council law, there's another door right here that says, exit over it. As a bright neon sign, exit. So who is to blame if we have to suddenly get out, and we don't see. We're not aware of where the exit is. The law of the land has designated you have to have a door with an exit sign over it. So people, in the event of a problem, can escape. So Krishna has put so many exit signs in material existence. But we don't want to see it. Exit. Who would want to leave this place? Here we can do what we like, especially when the economy is good. And there's so many IT jobs. We can do what we like. Then when the economy gets a little bad, oh, we wonder what's going on. When we have nice relationships and material existence seems peaceful, we feel quite content. But when the inevitable upsets come, then we become very disturbed. And we don't think, let me exit material existence. We think, let me blame Krishna. Why has he made a world like this that does not fulfill my desires? It's amazing how we have it in our mind that the purpose of this world is to fulfill our desires. No. The purpose of this world is that you learn how your illicit desires can't be fulfilled. But somehow that we just think it's natural. I have desires. I want this. I want that. Just like he's feeling, I want toys. So, where are the toys? I want them. They should just come. So we are like big children. I have desires. I want to be happy. I want to enjoy my senses in this way and that way. I want respect. I want fame. I want prestige. I want conveniences. I want life to become easier. Let it happen. Approaching the path of bhakti means a major transformation in our vision of the purpose of this world. We start to recognize that instead of this world having as its purpose the fulfillment of our desires, actually this world exhausts your material desires, frustrates them. So either you become angry or you become smart and use that frustration to go to a higher level. Krishna is very expert in designing a world that won't work for you. That's his mercy. But we have such a stubborn desire to be happy in material existence that we don't see the purpose. In fact, we feel this world should make me happy in whatever pursuit I choose. And if we're not happy, we think, I don't have enough education, I don't have enough money, I'm not in the right relationship, I'm not in the right house, I don't have the right TV. Let me change it up. Change this one, change that one. Move here, move there, change my TV, change my relationship, change my job. On and on and on it goes. Meanwhile, the only real change that is significant going on, we don't notice. That's the change of body. Change your body, so what? What's the big deal? But change your body. I was speaking about this at a Bhagavad Gita workshop in Wellington last week, Thursday. Change your body, big deal. What's so relevant about changing the body? Even if you believe in reincarnation as a change of the body, so what? Yet, when we look at Bhagavad Gita, we see that Krishna emphasizes the change of the body, being aware that the body is changing, as a foundation of human knowledge and intelligence. Without that, you can't go any further. He explains later in the Bhagavad Gita, how those who are bewildered, they can't see how the body is changing. They don't care to understand how they got the present body or what the next body will be. They don't see all these changes. But someone whose eyes are trained in self-realization, they can understand these things. So we don't want to be victimized by material nature in such a way that we can't even understand the basics of what is going on. How is human society going to be rescued from such a degraded condition in which there's money in the bank account sometimes, there's so many conveniences in the house sometimes, but then you have lost sight of the goal of human life? This weekend at New Nandagram, we're having an interesting time. We had an audience of about 75, more or less, new persons to Krishna consciousness. So I decided to take a chance and have them participate in a thought experiment. I discussed it very carefully with Nandamandir and Koparvindesh Prabhus. Maybe this could be too radical. What do you think? But then they gave their approval. Now just see the audience. Overseas students from India, overseas professionals who are here in Australia to make it. And make it big. And become glorified by all the relatives back in India. So I decided we're going to show the documentary produced by Bhakti Vaibhav Swami, The Lost Village, about how village life is becoming lost. Now just imagine you have all these career-focused individuals who are either studying in school or often studying and working a job, or who have finished school and they are absorbed in their jobs or absorbed in looking for a job, and we're going to show them a documentary about village life in India. It's quite interesting. So I explained it to them carefully beforehand, of course. Look, it's not that we are advocating you should go back to the village. Don't worry. But what we are trying to do is, let's think. Is my present lifestyle, or are my present ambitions for a lifestyle, are they really, is it all really necessary? Maybe I don't need such a frantic, stressful way of life to make me happy and fulfilled. I gave them social statistics from the UK. It's always easy to blame some other country. I explained how the government official surveys have found that the vast majority of people feel that they have lifestyle problems. They're overworked, they're overstressed, they suffer from fatigue, they can't get enough sleep, and they can't get any exercise. These are the things on their mind. So, all right, you have very fancy conveniences in your home. You have all the mod cons. But you're too stressed out to be happy. You don't even have any time to be at home. So I was explaining to our audience how I said, you know, this is the way of life that you're going to accept. Whether you're in Australia or you return to India, the frantic, stressful lifestyle has taken over the whole world. Nityananda Priya Prabhu was telling me about one devotee who, it happens, the wife wanted to raise the child in India as opposed to raising the child in Aussie culture. So, yeah, the dutiful husband took the family back to India so the child could have a better life. But then the husband's working 9:30. He leaves the house in the morning and comes back 11:30 at night. So, you go to get the better life for the child, but the child never sees the father. This is what's going on these days. So therefore, I showed them this documentary to stimulate the thinking process. The documentary, if you haven't seen it, is presenting a very idealized life of in the village. It's better for your health, it's better for relationships, better for the family. So then I said, after everyone viewed it, okay, what do you think? Are you ready for this? Are you ready to go back to the village? We're not asking you to, but are you ready? In other words, why are you here in your present situation? What's the reason? And all 75 persons looked at me like, Swamiji, you want to know why we're here? The money. I said, okay, you're here for the money. But will the money lead to the peace and happiness you want? The social statistics show it doesn't. So think about it. And indeed they began to think, what's it all about? I'm pursuing something so frantically, like a herd mentality. Yet what I'm pursuing, what the herd is pursuing, is not working. So who am I trying to please? And then we went over, we analyzed all the different pressures that are upon them. Family pressure. You cannot go overseas to Australia and return home a failure. No, you're supposed to make it big. And then you can return, fly back a few times a year, and show your prowess. Yes, I have such a powerful job. Everything is working for me overseas. And the relatives can be so, can feel proud that you're in the family. And then also, anyway, so we presented to them that something is not working. There has to be some radical shift of vision. And that's what Krishna is asking for. A radical shift in vision. Instead of being the enjoyer-exploiter, we become Krishna's servants. So, once you understand that basic principle, you can understand Varnashram Dharma. Why it has prescribed duties. Especially for people in the West, the term prescribed duty sounds like poison. This is prescribed duty nonsense. It's very primitive. Because of this kind of thinking that India has been held back. Although now that it's imitating the West, it's finally roaring ahead. For centuries, India has been held back by this concept of prescribed duties. There's only one duty, and that is to your mind and senses. How do you feel today? Just pursue it. Something has come to your mind? Get into it. Go for it. That is civilization. You made a promise last week, but that was last week. This week is another week. When you made the promise, you really mean, you meant it. But it was last week. Everyone understands. In fact, everyone understands that principle so well that no one even makes promises anymore. And no vows anymore. So this is the situation. Yet, when people come to the world of bhakti, they're presented with prescribed duties. There are prescribed spiritual duties, and there are prescribed material duties. Varnashram Dharma is a material system, without a doubt. That's why Lord Chaitanya, in his confidential discussions with Sri Ramananda Roy, Lord Chaitanya rejects Varnashram Dharma because Lord Chaitanya wanted Ramananda Roy to go for the topmost, the most confidential dimension of the spiritual world. So Varnashram Dharma is a material system. It's about the body. It's about material propensities. And how to organize those propensities so that one can make spiritual progress. But still, it's a material system. But what is the value of Varnashram Dharma? It is Krishna's material system. The material energy comes from Krishna, so why can't Krishna have a material system for living in the material energy? We stress Varnashram Dharma because it's Krishna's personal system for how bodies should inhabit the material world. And in our sampradaya, the acharyas have asked for Varnashram Dharma. Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada. Because they understand it's Krishna's system. We cannot reject Krishna's system. We have to at least know what it is and try to apply it to some measure. Otherwise, we're impersonalists. We cannot just, this Varnashram Dharma, it's just too complicated, it's too unwieldy. Srila Prabhupada asked that we think about it, think about how to apply it. And he would bring it up at least three times during his stay with us over the 10 or 12 or 13 years of his ISKCON years. He would bring it up. And in fact, in his last year, in 77, he said, the time is more right now than when I first brought it up. He wouldn't give up. He would just keep bringing it up again and again. And sometimes devotees would have the understanding, misunderstanding. But didn't Lord Caitanya say Varnashram Dharma is of the material world, so why should we be concerned with it? We're Vaishnavs. We are devotees. And as you know, Prabhupada gave the famous quip, well, if everyone's a devotee, why are they falling down? In other words, something else is needed. Some social buttressing, some material social stability is needed to hold devotees in place, to keep them from drowning while they're endeavoring to step onto the spiritual platform firmly. So that is the glory of Varnashram Dharma. It is a material system to allow yourself to find your footing firmly on the spiritual platform. Now we look at the world today. In India, we see the remnants of Varnashram Dharma. I was explaining to the crowd that gathered this weekend at New Nandagram. I often ask this question. Why is it that you have an employment advantage in the job market? Why do employers want Indians? Everyone was very patriotic and quick to answer. We work hard. We are very duty conscious. We don't come to the job on Monday hungover. We have family values, therefore we don't go to work and have anxieties about family problems. We just go to work and we work. Sometimes they'll say, and we work cheaper. So, I explain that actually all these values that you brought up are remnants of Varnashram Dharma. Yet, you're going to act in the future in such a way that will destroy the very culture that provides these values. You're going to forget the culture that gives you the competitive advantage in the workplace. And then you'll be on equal footing with everyone else in the Wild West. We look at the life of the typical person who's grown up outside of India, and even the traditional Christian culture of morality is long gone. Family life is disappearing fast. Even in the USA, which is known as a religious country in the first world, according to Western religious standards, the USA is known as a religious country, a Christian country. More adults are living without a family than within a family. So when people come to Krishna consciousness from such backgrounds, they generally don't have anything material going for them that allows stability in spiritual life. If they had a family that stayed together, which is doubtful, that family is not spiritually supportive because the family doesn't know what actually causes the development of spiritual life. They don't know. Sometimes they're even antagonistic. Often they're just ignorant. So the candidate for bhakti can't rely on family background. Indeed, India is also heading in that direction. Life in the fast lane in Mumbai and Delhi and Bangalore. When there's no family values, as Arjuna pointed out to Krishna in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when the family tradition is destroyed, everything just degenerates. Everyone goes to hell. So, there's no proper family background. And then you look to the government for inspiration and support. No, the government couldn't care less that you're practicing bhakti. I always ask the question, How many of you have gotten certificates in the post from the government congratulating you on your taking up of bhakti? We have heard you are following the 9 processes of devotional service. We are so happy to have you in this nation. Please, there's a special toll-free number you can call for any support that you need. In fact, there are tax exemptions that you can have as an individual just because you chose to take up the 9 processes of devotional service. There's nothing going on like that. So because there is no supportive culture, it may seem like when people come to Krishna consciousness from the Western world, it's like a big leap, a do or die jump. And there's no safety net. It's like Arjuna presents in Bhagavad Gita, the classic problem. Krishna, what happens to those who take up the transcendental path and who later they desist, they have a problem? As far as I can see, what's going to happen is they're going to be like a cloud that just the wind has dissipated in the sky. They have no position in the spiritual world and no position in the material world. Krishna, can you please resolve this doubt? This is what happens when there's no supportive material setting for devotees to practice bhakti within. In that situation, Krishna consciousness looks like a... What is it? You've been to the circus? You've been to the circus? No. You know what a circus is, though, right? They have the acrobats on the high... What is it? Trapeze? Shamasundar, you've been? Ah, he's been to the circus. You've seen the guys on the... No. Becoming Krishna conscious, it seems, in this day and age, is like a trapeze, an acrobat, or walking on the high wire. One false move and down you plunge. There's no safety net. That was the great treasure of India, that the culture provided a material safety net of traditions, protocols, ways of doing things, so that your life, your material life, wouldn't be so chaotic as you try to become Krishna conscious. So Srila Prabhupada, as the Acharya, seeing the situation in the world, he clearly understood. I don't want Krishna consciousness just to be a high trapeze act, high wire walking act, in which you do or die. What is it? It was in New Zealand last week at Nishitagoshi in Wellington. I was telling the devotees a vivid example. When I was, new devotee, I think it was 1974. There were about 100 of us in the Brahmachari ashram. We were trying to go to sleep, our sleeping bags on the floor. And one Brahmachari, he was just pacing the floor. And it didn't keep anyone from going to sleep because our pace of engagement in devotional service was so intense, no one had any problems falling asleep. There was no insomnia problems. So I noticed as I was drifting off to sleep, he's pacing back and forth. And then when I woke up in the morning at 3 o'clock, it was normal to wake up at 3 o'clock because 100 brahmacharis and 2 showers. there'd be a long line at the shower. You'd step into the shower, no question of hot water. There was a statement out, a supposed quotation from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that hot showers were breaking the regular principles. So that was that quotation. Was circulated amongst all the young devotees. So, we didn't want to take any hot shower. We want to break the regular principles. So, there's like lines of 30 brahmacharis per shower. And you were allowed 60 seconds. And if you just went a few seconds over, everyone had like a clock in their minds, you know, the other Brahmins had a clock. 60 seconds, Prabhu! 60 seconds! So, anyway, I got up at 3 o'clock, and there he was, still pacing. And so, I said, Prabhu, you've been up all night doing this? Yes, I've been up all night. You see, soon it's going to be Mangal Arati. In 1 hour, an hour and a half, at 4:30, it's going to be Mangal Arati. And I have vowed, I've got to figure out what decision I'm going to take before the Mangal Arati conch blows. Either I take sannyas, or I get married. I've got to figure it out before the conch shell blows. It's one or the other. So that was, the way things were in the beginning. But Prabhupada understood, this is not a way to have longevity. This is not a way to have a lasting Krishna conscious society. Why should devotees make such extreme choices and be in such extreme consciousness? So therefore, Prabhupada saw the need. Just as Krishna saw the need. Now, there should be a favorable material setting for people to be Krishna conscious. So they can go through their phases in life with smooth progression. Not in a herky-jerky or mad, frantic way. And that way is supposed, that smooth, progressive way is supposed to be Varnashram Dharma, Krishna's material system. So gradually, in ISKCON we're trying to bring in prescribed duties. This chapter talks about what happens when the prescribed duty of each ashram, brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas, what happens when those prescribed duties are not followed. Just like this verse is talking about bogus sannyasis who adopt the sannyas lifestyle for the purpose of bodily maintenance, upajivati, utilizing for one's bodily maintenance, tridandam, the sannyas order of life, upajivati, utilizing it for one's bodily maintenance. You read in Lilamrita, Srila Prabhupada's memories of India at the very beginning of the 20th century, how his father, seeking to follow grihastha dharma, the prescribed duties of a grihastha, his father would always invite people for dinner. He would go open the door, look out in the street, and see anyone wearing saffron, look or dressed like a babaji or a holy person. Please come in, eat. And Srila Prabhupada commented how he, as a child, could see so many of these holy persons were charlatans, persons who had taken up this renounced attire just for the purpose of filling their belly. But he said his father was very liberal and just took things at face value. Oh, you're a Babaji, you're a Swami, you're a Brahmachari, come in, take prasad. So those were Srila Prabhupada's memories of so many charlatans taking up renounced attire just to fill their bellies. Therefore, he didn't want to go see Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur when his friend invited him. I've seen a great holy person. And Prabhupada's response was, as a young man, oh, I've seen so many so-called holy persons. No, thank you. No, come. He's different. He's the real thing. No. I've seen them all. I know what it's like. That was the situation. I think Nanda Mandir was telling me how recently in India there's been a big scandal. One Mayavadi sannyasi has a world following. He was exposed to be in a compromising situation. He had some American disciples, and they had some idea that he was doing some illicit activity. He because he had movie stars as followers. So with their American ingenuity, they put one of those tiny cameras in his room. The next time he'll know better than to have American disciples. So it's so easy to get these digital cameras that see everything. They're getting smaller and smaller, and no doubt the so-called Swami wasn't thinking about such things. He was thinking about the movie star. So then it came out, the pictures caught in a compromising posture with the movie starlet.
And so what did he tell the newspapers as his defense?
You see, actually, I was in samadhi the whole time. And every guru in the world has to go through this test of apparently being in such a compromising posture, but actually you're in samadhi, you see. This is part of being a guru. It's part of being a sannyasi, that you're apparently in this situation, but actually you're not in this situation. Apparently, though, even in India today, which is rapidly changing, still there is some sense of dignity, and so people are going to they're making a court case against him. Why? You are putting yourself forward as a renounced person, but by your activities, we can see it as something else. So therefore, you should be taken to court as being a fraud. What would happen in the Western world if you dared accuse such a person of being of doing something wrong? In the Western world, they would probably take you to court. What are you doing criticizing this man who's simply, achieving the ultimate goal of life? How dare you criticize him? You will sue you. This is the way things are. Why does the Bhagavatam speak so strongly about not following prescribed duty and, in fact, being a pretender about your prescribed duty? Because the Bhagavatam is presenting that a culture is needed that allows human beings to make gradual progress in spiritual life, to hold them in place. So they're not do or die. Often, it can seem, especially when Westerners, those who have taken their birth outside India, that includes a lot of Indians these days also, they're taking their birth outside of India. So becoming Krishna conscious can seem to be like a do or die event. Either I make it all the way back to Godhead, or I'm finished. And then this perception causes the person to think that, well, it's obvious I haven't become a pure devotee after 2 years in the ashram, so therefore I might as well just go the other way completely and just get right back into sense gratification. It's one or the other. Either I'm a pure bhakta or shuddha bhakta, or else I'm a sense enjoyer. There's no in-between ground. So Varnashram Dharma is a culture that deals with attachment. How to gradually become free of attachment. And it's the most ingenious system for that. It's Krishna's system. There are rules for every ashram. You're going to hear soon about the rules for the Grihastha ashram, the rules for the Brahmacharya ashram. Things, what should not be done. Just like here in this verse, you're hearing about what sannyasi should not do. Chi dandam upajivati. They shouldn't use the sannyasa order of life for bodily maintenance. The more we can understand what is legitimate prescribed duty, the more our Krishna consciousness will have a firm foundation in this world. Of course, sometimes, especially for those coming from India, they manufacture prescribed duties. Well, Swamiji, Krishna says, you must do your duty. Therefore, I'm striving to become CEO because Krishna says, you must do your duty. Prescribed duty means according to a particular status in life. It's not that you can just pick anything you like and say, it's my prescribed duty. And what is the purpose of all these prescribed duties? That purpose is made very clear in Srimad Bhagavatam. The purpose is to revive your love of Krishna. Otherwise, the Bhagavatam says, what's the use of all these prescribed duties? You have to understand what the purpose is. The purpose of your being a brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. What's the purpose of it all? What's the purpose of all the occupational divisions? It's all about developing your love for Krishna. Otherwise, you've wasted your time. So similarly, in our various statuses in life, we need to see, how is my love for Krishna developing? That means, how is my love for devotional service developing? Is devotional service a burden to me, or is it a joy? Just like in any relationship, is the relationship a burden, or is it a burden of love? That's a different kind of burden. But certainly, we can feel overburdened by devotional service, and that's a great luxury. Krishna has been kind upon you if you're overburdened by devotional service. And then you have to approach Krishna for the intelligence, how to navigate through that flood of devotional service. But never, never feel bad that, oh, I'm flooded with devotional service. What's becoming of me? This is just too much Krishna consciousness. Have you ever seen that verse in Bhagavatam warning you? Too much Krishna. Anyone found the verse? Let us not blame devotional service, and let us always be thankful to Krishna for the flood of devotional service, but we need to develop intelligence how to handle the flood. So we thank Krishna for the flood, and we beg Krishna for the intelligence how to navigate through the flood waters, but we never want the flood to stop. The more that we learn to become grateful for devotional service, especially when there's a flood, the more we can advance in spiritual life, because we're understanding eternally life is about devotional service. That's my eternal occupation. So I might as well learn how to cope with this eternal flood.